Welcome to this Worldview podcast for Engelsberg Ideas and the latest of our reflections on war. I'm Adam Bolton. Today we're talking about a global issue where a rebalancing is taking place as a consequence of the war in Ukraine, the competition for resources, especially for access to energy. In this episode, I'm joined by Professor Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge University and the author of Disorder and Hard Times in the 21st Century, by Tim Marshall, author of Prisoners of Geography, and by Dr. Daniel Yergin, advisor on energy and climate change to a number of US administrations over the past 20 years or so, whose most recent book is The New Map, Energy, Climate and the Clash of Nations, which takes a wide-ranging view of geopolitics of energy. First, I spoke to Helen Thompson and I asked her if the perception of the Ukrainian war is that the West knows what it's about, Russia knows what it's about, but the problem is in fact really resources, oil and gas.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that the European energy relationship, in particular with Russia, has constrained the way in which not only I think that the Western countries have responded to the war once it started, but constrained the way in which they saw, particularly the European countries, and in particular Germany, or at least most consequentially Germany, the way that they saw what was going on for the previous two decades. And in some sense, I think that the dependency of European energy on Russian oil and gas and the pipelines issue, where that gas was coming from, and the attempt to bypass Ukraine that the Germans participated in, if you looked at it pretty carefully, you could see that Putin was trying to use energy as an instrument of geopolitical power to the European countries' disadvantage and to Russia's advantage.
Is it fair to say that we, in Europe in particular, are effectively financing both sides in the war because of our dependence on that energy?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, I think that that's true. And that if you look at the revenue that on a monthly basis from oil and gas exports, it's never been higher. And the reason for that, quite obviously, is that the consequence of the war and the energy shock that has come with it is that prices are very high. And prices are very high. Russian supply can't easily be replaced. So Russian revenues go up.
What about that dependence, though? Was it inevitable or could we have found some other way of getting our energy?
I think you've got to break this down into like time periods. I think in the 2000s that it's quite difficult to see how European countries and Germany in particular had that much alternative but to continue with the gas relationship with Russia. Now, one can argue about whether they should have been accepting Putin's moves to move away from transit on Ukraine. But I think that's a separate issue.
But it was also, in Germany's case, I mean, partly a consequence of turning against nuclear power and coal as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, in some sense, they're not red herrings, but I don't think they're the underlying explanation of what went on. I mean, if you go back to like 2003, and I think this is a point where you can see things quite clearly, and you look at what happened after the Iraq war when it looked like it had been successful, one of the first things that Blair did after that was to invite Putin to the UK on a state visit. I think it was the first time there'd been a Russian state visit to London since the latter part of the 19th century. And that was because there wasn't much alternative at that point but to deal with Russia as a gas provider in particular. What changed, and this is where I think options emerged, was the 2010s, because at that point the boom which had begun in liquid natural gas exports was really accelerated by the emergence of the United States as a gas
from shale.
And in one sense, the decisive then German choice became when the Germans said, no, we're not interested not only in liquid natural gas from the US, but we're not really interested in it at all, and built no liquid natural gas ports.
So in a sense, was that a geostrategic decision that we prefer to be friendly with Russia than with America to a certain extent, or dependent?
I think it got really tangled at this point. On the one hand, I think you say you can clearly see there was a commercial basis to it because pipelined Russian gas was cheaper than seaborne American gas. And the Germans by this point had entrenched relations with Russian gas companies, in particular Gazprom. And a number of the German energy companies were entwined in production partnerships with Gazprom and some of the Russian oil company. So it would have been a big moment for Germany to give up on that. I also think that the fact that American Shell producers were going to commercially benefit also got in the way, in a sense, of German government thinking about it as a geopolitical move, because the German position became, well, the Americans are just saying that because they want their shale producers to make money out of us. And so I think that that, in a way, made it harder for Germany to concentrate on the geopolitical issue, which, by the point this is really coming to a crisis point, I would say, which is 2016, is after the Crimea annexation, after Russia is under sanctions. So Merkel goes ahead and gives the green light to the Nord Stream pipeline, which in some sense is a symbol of that relationship and that choice, after those sanctions are in place and after Crimea has become Russian.
Wasn't there an opportunity in this period, the last two decades, for people to say, no, we're going to go for alternative sort of energy, we're going to look for renewable energy?
Yes, but you've got to think about like what gas is doing in the energy mix. And obviously, when gas was being used in electricity, for electricity generation, there's the possibility of using renewables more. But Germany wasn't slow in going down the road of renewables. Now, you could say that Germany's issue is complicated because of the nuclear power decision that Merkel made in 2011. But the crucial thing, I think, with gas is to recognise its importance in heating. And renewables in themselves don't do anything about that. You've got to move into heat pumps and then think about the electricity that, you know, fuels that and where that electricity is coming from. So you can't just say more renewables equals less gas.
Or hydrogen.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that these are possibilities, but none of them at the moment can do what oil and gas can do.
If we look at the situation in Ukraine, was there really a miscalculation on both sides, that President Putin clearly thought that dependence on Russian gas would not result in a concerted Western opposition to his position, and the Germans clearly thought he wasn't going to invade Ukraine?
If we start with the German assumption, I think, was that as long as that there was relative peace, and I stress relative peace in Europe because of what had happened in 2014, that there wasn't any real geopolitical risk to their energy relationship with Russia. And the possibility that Putin could have prosecuted the kind of war that he has and essentially stripped their moral choice away from them, and to turn it into a moral choice, is not something I think that had occurred to the German political establishment, if that's what we can call it. I think that Putin looks like, I hesitate about saying anything very definitive about him, looks like he'd been taken aback by some of the response where energy is concerned. The caveats I would put there is the only decisive thing that the EU has done, obviously, is on coal, of banning all coal imports, and that's not so consequential as the oil and gas situation. I think he's probably, though, more taken aback just because it's been such a decisive move by the central bank sanctions and the fact that half of Russia's foreign exchange reserves have been confiscated, because clearly he was being pretty strategic about foreign exchange reserves and gold reserves, building them up. It was part of his response to the sanctions in 2014. But for him to have left half of them out of the country, or half of them out of Russia, where they could then be confiscated, I can't believe that he thought that that was a possibility, because if he had considered it as a possibility, I think they would have been in Russia when the war had started.
And in terms of resources and energy sources, do you see now a strategic and permanent shift in approach in Germany and the rest of Europe?
Yes, I do. In this sense, I think any idea that the issues around energy can be compartmentalised is over. And that's true whether we're thinking about the economics of energy in relation to the geopolitics of energy, and it's true if we're thinking about the relationship between the energy transition and the present tense problems around the supply of oil and gas in particular, and the price of those. And I think that governments, you know, are right across the world, but I think that probably in poorer countries, they were already more cognizant of this reality, have got to get to grips with the energy situation across the board. You can't just like dice the problem up into lots of different bits and say, oh, we're dealing with that in this way, we're dealing with that in this way. It's systemic, it has systemic consequences, has to be thought of across the whole at the same time. And I think the war has made that extraordinarily clear.
I mean, you use the word transition. Someone else was saying it's not a transition, it's a revolution.
That's what usually my phrase is, actually.
Yeah, oh, it's your phrase then. Sorry, it was you saying it. Are we really showing signs that we're up for that revolution?
In a way, yes, I think, in this sense, is that given the time scales and given the fact that there's not been a technological breakthrough yet on storage, if we want to move rapidly, then there has to be serious questions asked about energy consumption and whether energy consumption can be maintained at present levels. And the answer is no, it can't, if we're going to make that transition, given where we are at the moment. And again, I think the war has put the question of energy consumption and the volume of energy consumption really on the table in Western democracies, particularly, I would say, in Europe. So you have Mario Draghi quite openly saying you better turn the air conditioning down. Now, in a way, he was sort of making a flippant remark about that. But if you go back to last autumn, when there was a brewing energy crisis before Omicron variant, it wasn't really politically feasible, I think, for any Western politician anyway to talk about reducing energy consumption. The war has made that possible. In fact, the war has in some sense introduced it as an existential question, and that has important implications for the energy transition because it's existential in relation to Russia and it's existential in relation to the energy transition and the fact that we need to think about those. So again, I'd say the war has shifted things by getting us to take energy and the predicaments that energy creates much more seriously.
And has it shifted us also towards seriously exploring more stable, more secure sources of supply of energy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the tricky part, because in one sense at the moment, particularly where oil's concerned, you pick your poison. You can take it from Russia. You can think about bringing Iran back into world oil markets more significantly anyway, obviously, because some Iranian oil has been finding its way into those markets. You can get closer to the Saudis. You can get closer to the UAE. I mean, these are not without their own, shall we say, ethical and geopolitical dilemmas, particularly where the Iran nuclear deal is concerned. I think the other place where we should expect to see considerable, at least, complication is the Eastern Mediterranean, where there have been various gas projects involve, again, complicated pipeline questions. They involve dealing with Turkey's grievances about being excluded from those developments thus far. Now, you could say, and I think I would say this, it's not as tricky as ongoingly dealing with Russia, but it's not without its complications.
And you've also got countries that are heavily dependent, Poland, Italy. What are they doing? What can they do?
Well, I mean, some of this, I think, is really hard for a country like Hungary. And obviously Hungary is the one that has been sort of holding up the EU sanctions, or at least it's been most vociferous in what it said on the subject. And there you've got to just look at basic things like the fact that Hungary is landlocked, it's got a refinery, that's on the Drazba pipeline, and that it can't at the moment, obviously, without making some arrangements with probably Croatia, import oil by sea. Oh, not so easily anyway, make a rapid adjustment. And these are things that really do constrain what those European countries in the middle of the continent can do. And we've also then got to think about, well, if the answer is more supply from the United States, which is the world's largest oil producer, after all, is how quickly can American shale oil producers get back on track to producing the kinds of volumes that they were before the pandemic. And at the moment, only one of the shale oil fields in the United States is doing that. The others have fallen away quite significantly. So probably more supply is going to mean more investment in the shale sector in the US. And that's something that's politically problematic. It's politically contested. It runs into ESG considerations. So that side of it has got to be thought about as well.
Let's turn away from energy for a moment. What other resources do you see in the world as being significant, the supply of them having a significant impact on geopolitics?
Well, I think we're clearly heading to, if we're not already there, rare earth minerals becoming pretty important because they're in, metals are a central part of the energy transition. They're necessary in, from a whole range of things, from the actual solar panels through to battery issues. And the situation at the moment is that China dominates the production and extraction of them and the supply chains around them. And that is something that politicians in Washington on both sides of the party divide are very keen to address. I mean, in the latter part of the Trump presidency, Trump had a national emergency declared about metal extraction, and it's pretty much in place, although it's...
I mean, it's not just in China, is it? It's globally.
Yeah, it is.
Latin America, yeah,
absolutely.
And Africa.
Absolutely. Everybody outside China wants to challenge China's position. And for the US, that is a huge deal because they don't want to be metal dependent upon China. And I think that it's important to see that although that the green energy revolution transition, call it what we will, it's going to take away, as it happens, some of the struggles over the world's resources that are very arbitrarily geographically, you know, distributed, like oil and gas. It's not going to take away entirely this struggle for extraction of the world's resources. And whilst I don't think metals are, say, as unevenly distributed as oil and gas have been, there's still going to be quite a sharp geopolitics around that, including because China starts with such strategic advantages because it's been strategic about rare earth minerals going back to the Mao years and very early Mao years at that in the 1950s.
And is it, as you say, because of their need for machines or is it because of digital technology? I mean, they're important there as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. Metals are not only important for the green energy transition, they're also important for the digital tech revolution, whatever we want to call that. And we can see, I think, you know, like already that some of the impacts of the war are being felt on the metal side as well, because Russia is pretty well endowed on that side too.
And this feeds into solar panels as well.
Yeah, it does.
I get the sense from what you're saying is that we, Western governments, global institutions, are just not thinking about a lot of this stuff.
I think sometimes it's easy to come to that conclusion, and sometimes that I think that. And I think that it's certainly true in Europe that there was considerable complacency about the geopolitics of the energy relationship with Russia and a lot of wishful thinking when it didn't take too much looking to see that Putin thought about energy as a geopolitical weapon and in some sense was trapping European countries in their dependency. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the history of the 20th century, it's pretty clear that governments were spending a lot of time thinking about energy questions and they thought about them quite strategically. Now, I would say that the situation, I think, in which Western politicians face today on the energy landscape is mind-bogglingly more difficult in many ways than anything that's been faced before because of the fact that we're trying to engage in this energy revolution, which in some sense would rewrite the material, you know, foundations of the entire way in which the world economy works, the entire way in which we live our lives. Nothing like this has really been tried before, and they are trying to do it at a time which, in their own terms, leaving aside the ecological consequences that fossil fuel energy cause a lot of difficulty because of the fact of the supply constraints that seem to be in place while demand for them has still been rising in the way in which it has. So I think there's probably more thinking going on about it than looks on the surface. On the other hand, I think for anybody to try to get to grips with what it all entails, you know, it's just an enormous task.
Helen Thompson on getting to grips with the current problems for setting energy resources. A subject she touched on earlier was the Eastern Mediterranean, an area that the author and broadcaster Tim Marshall has been looking at recently and where there is something of a rebalancing of resources taking place. His best-selling books include Prisoners of Geography and The Power of Geography. So did he think the potential of the Eastern Mediterranean has been overlooked in the current assessments of energy supply and capability beyond Russia and Western Europe?
Yeah, I was looking at the Eastern Med and the Aegean for the past couple of years, ever since there was this discovery of huge reserves of gas and, to a lesser extent, oil in waters which, under international law, are Cypriot and Greek, but because Turkey doesn't adhere to or recognise some of the rulings, thinks that or says that some of it is theirs, and it's been very, very tense down there, to the extent that the Greek and Turkish navies were busy shadowing each other and trying to stop each other's drilling exploration ships. But this year, it's become even more important because of the Ukraine-Russia war, which in many sense economically is a global war. The war there has led to a focus on whether people are going to go ahead with various pipelines from Israel and Egypt. But also the European Union went off to Egypt last month to sign a deal with Israel and Egypt, because Israel sends its gas to Egypt. Egypt makes it into liquefied natural gas and is now going to be sending it off to the EU to try to replace some of the gas that the Russians will not be sending this winter.
That will be by ship, presumably, liquefied natural gas.
Yes, because the pipelines aren't there yet. But, you know, long term, there is going to be this switch. And there is also this Israeli Cypriot Greek, it's called the East Med gas pipeline, and it would pipe Israeli gas to Cyprus, onto Greece, onto Italy, and then up into the EU. There's a lot of cost issues involved. It may not really come to fruition, but I think that the Ukraine-Russia war has made it more likely it now might go ahead, despite the Americans thinking, well, we're not going to get involved in it, we don't think it's viable. So it's just another interesting aspect of how genuinely the Ukraine-Russia war is a global war, whether it's semiconductors, grain for Ethiopia, or in this particular instance, energy.
And let's be clear, you mentioned Cypriot Turkish oil and gas, but Israel as well is now, you know, the tables have turned really, and Israel is also now an energy producer.
Yes. It's funny, isn't it, Adam? I think many of us are often sort of several years out of date in our immediate thinking. We still think, when we think of energy, of Saudi, Kuwait, to a lesser extent, America and Russia.
Qatar, yeah.
But a lot of things have been happening in the recent years that they just haven't made the sort of headlines that they might have done once upon a time, and three of them. One is Israel and this massive, massive gas fields that it's found off its coast, which has made Israel energy self-sufficient. It's exporting. It's going to be a massive money earner for them in the next decade. Ditto Egypt. They have the Zohr offshore field. They found it about 8 years ago. They are now also an exporter of energy. And then we come to the Greek-Turkey issue. Most of this gas is Greek and Cypriot. And again, they are going to be huge suppliers. But I don't think any of those three countries have really impacted on our consciousness. But they are game changers in the geopolitical sense.
And also game changers in, as you say, in geopolitical sense, because you've got Israel now in partnership with Arab states, Muslim states.
Yeah. Again, this is all part of a seismic shift. I mean, the Abraham Accords, signed by the Trump administration and continued by the Biden administration, brought in partnerships with places like Israel and the UAE, Sudan, Bahrain, and other countries. And underpinning it is Israel's strategic position, its technology, things that it has for desalination of water, all sorts of things, but also its energy. And so now you have this really solidifying relationship with Egypt, where, I mean, I know they've been at peace for decades, but now they have this incredibly huge economic link and interests, which makes war between them absolutely unthinkable. And also what's happening, not the Arab world, but the Middle Eastern world, Turkey, after 10 years of really freezing Israel out, is now forging its relations again. And again, a lot of it is to do with energy, because this Israel, Cyprus, Greece, Italy route may well go ahead now because of Ukraine-Russia.
As a pipeline.
Yeah, sorry, that's the pipeline. But the Turks, who see that, of course, as a competition for them, are also talking to the Israelis now, well, maybe we should have our own pipeline coming out and through Turkey. You know, they do see themselves as a natural bridge from the Middle East and into Europe. So all this stuff is now swirling around, but is not making headlines. Now, obviously, in the energy world and in the geopolitical world, people are aware of it, but, you know, I'm not sure it's really gone out there into public consciousness. The Turkey-Greece one, though, is, for me, the most delicate, because it's the one which could actually end up in a shooting match. Now, it probably won't. I don't want to be Cassandra here. But the Turkish have been very bellicose in their language. Forgive me for going into the technicals, Adam, but it's the EEZs, the Exclusive Economic Zones. Under the United Nations Law of the Sea, 200 miles in any direction from your coastline is your EEZ. Of course, if you are equidistant to another country, France and Britain being the example, you share 50%, 50-50. The problem for the Turks is some of the Greek islands are only a mile off the Turkish coast. So Turkey gets half a mile of the Aegean, but in the other direction, Greece gets 200 miles. So Turkey doesn't actually recognise UNCLOS. It abides by a different ruling which comes down to continental shelves, and it can prove that its continental shelf stretches out into the parts of the sea where the gas is. So they say half of it's ours. Greece says no, it's got very sticky. As I said, the two navies were shadowing each other. The French in 2020 took Greece's side and actually sent their aircraft carrier down there to assist the Greek navy against the Turkish navy. So those are the stakes that they're playing for. Two NATO powers, very unlikely they could go to war, but accidents do happen.
And just as a sideline before we get back onto energy, where does all this leave the Palestinians and indeed the factions in Lebanon?
Lebanon's the bigger issue probably because there is this border dispute. Now, Israel is going to arbitration over it. And again, it comes down to EEZs and where you draw your lines and at what angle out from your shoreline do you draw your line. Now, it'll come down to the UN. Lebanon and Israel are in dispute about it. Unfortunately, Hezbollah, which, as you know, is the most powerful military unit in Lebanon, it's more powerful than the actual Lebanese state army, it said that if Israel drills in the disputed area, it will act. In other words, it will take military action. Israel probably won't begin to drill there until it is resolved. It's a worry, but again, I think it's manageable.
I mean, Gaza's got coastline, hasn't it?
Yes, sorry, I was just coming to that. That is also disputed and at some point will be resolved. And it's another example of how if they could just put their differences to one side, which seems doubtful. Yep, Gaza, it's EEZ, although it's not a recognised sovereign state yet. But if it was, it would legally have its exclusive economic zone. It could then go into partnership with other countries, Egypt would be the obvious one, in which to develop any natural resources it has. But given the current situation between them, I wouldn't hold your breath on that one. I mean, it is a factor, but the big players in this region now, Egypt, Israel, to a lesser extent, Turkey, Greece and Cyprus.
Okay, now what we talked about really is the production of energy resources, which could, if you like, help the West and help the West wean off its dependency on Russian oil and gas. Where does Russia fit into this?
With its hand on the tap. You know, we're recording in the summer. Germany is still holding reasonably firm in its position within the EU of trying to keep the pressure on Russia, but I do worry about what will happen this winter when Germany starts to ration gas and hot water to its households. So Russia's still got its hand on the tap.
And there's Russian gas, as I understand it, going via Turkey as well.
Yes, and the EU is doing all sorts of things to try to race against the clock, but most of these things are so long-term structural, you know, you can't do it in 6 months. So, for example, they are accelerating work on LNG terminals in places like Poland. The Germans are going to build a couple of LNG terminals, but that's going to take at least 2 years. The EU has signed this deal with Israel and Egypt to get LNG in, but it's less than 5% of its needs. They're going held for leather on renewables, etc., etc. But it will not be enough in time for the winter, at which point Russia's energy as a weapon will become even more important. We will see where we are on the battlefield at that point. And if Russia at that point wants to pressurise for some sort of deal, that will be part of its arsenal. In the medium and long term, what it's also doing, quite understandably from its perspective, it is trying to channel more of its energy eastwards towards China and indeed India. Indian imports of Russian energy have gone up quite a lot because, of course, they're selling it cheap. but that they're also in extended and advanced talks with the Chinese about building new pipelines to get even more to China. So Russia's going to have a market for its energy, and it will use that, A, to make money, of course, but B, to offset its losses vis-a-vis the Europeans. So that whole energy policy that the EU has, and the Americans, to punish Russia, I think when it comes to actual sales of their energy, I think the effect is limited. I think the sanctions on Russia when it comes to things like aeroplane parts, car parts, big companies not investing, the SWIFT banking system, all that combined, is possibly more of a blow to Russia than actually people from the West and to its West not buying its energy, because it has these alternative markets.
And Tim, where does all this energy source, hydrocarbon source, primarily gas, but some oil as well, where does this leave the pursuit of net zero?
Yeah, I think it's delayed it even further. I mean, it's one of the real tragedies. The EU is a world leader in renewables and in trying to invest in renewables. And it's one of the reasons why it was hesitating over this Israel, Cyprus, Greek, Italy pipeline, because, of course, then you're investing in fossil fuels. But given the complexities and the urgency of basically keeping industry going, you know, they're having to rethink. And they're having to think, well, perhaps we are going to... Well, look at the Germans. They're going to go back to coal temporarily. The UK is looking at possibly opening a brand new coal field, first one in decades. The Chinese are going to open 25 new coal-fired power stations within a couple of years. It's a contradiction, isn't it? The major powers are all massively warning about the problems of climate change and of using fossil fuels, desperately trying to get onto renewables. And then along comes this massive crisis and short-termism, which is basically keeping us warm and keeping our lights on, kicks in. Short answer, it has delayed our acceleration towards net zero.
Well, Tim Marshall there on the effects of the current energy crisis and also new sources of supply, particularly in the Eastern Mediterranean region. Now, Dr. Daniel Yergin is a man who quite literally wrote the book, or rather books, about energy competition, The Prize, The Quest, and his new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate and the Clash of Nations, which foretold the stresses between Russia and Ukraine. I began by asking him how he felt the conflict had changed the world competition for resources.
Dramatically. Before the war on February 23rd, we had a global oil market and a global natural gas market. We don't have either right now. Instead, we have fragmented markets. And of course, we were already in a global energy crisis starting really in the autumn of 2021. It's now conjoined with a global geopolitical crisis. So we really have a combo crisis, and it's sent prices to levels that people had never really anticipated, particularly natural gas prices, and particularly right now, a big threat for Europe.
Was smashing the energy market part of Putin's calculation, in your view, in ordering the forces in?
No, I think Putin made four miscalculations. He overestimated his military. He underestimated the willpower and capabilities of the Ukrainians. He thought the U.S. was so sort of preoccupied with its own problems from the January 6th invasion of the Capitol and the way it had withdrawn from Afghanistan, that he assumed that the U.S. would not be able to get its act together. And fundamentally, on the energy front, he knows the energy business very well. He's de facto CEO of Russia Energy Inc., so to speak. And he assumed, because of the Europeans' high dependence on Russian energy, they would protest and say it's terrible, and then they would just kind of get on with business. And he completely misunderstood that for the Europeans, what the war he launched in Ukraine was a war he'd launched in Europe.
Yet there is this perception that even if he miscalculated, that he's won anyway on as far as energy is concerned, because that energy which is being bought at a high price.
I think short term, he's doing well out of this. He's making more money than he would have in the past. But I think over 2 years, it's going to really change. And 2 years from now, Russia will no longer be an energy superpower because it will have largely lost its most important market, Europe. So short term, he holds high cards, and he's playing those cards in a very rough game right now, basically cutting gas supplies to Europe in order to still fix his miscalculation and basically trying to create such economic hardship in Europe that, as he's actually said, he said it at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, bring populist governments to power in Europe, crack the alliance, and as he put it in almost Marxist terms, change the elites that are in power in Europe. So he knows what he's doing right now. And the Russians, who for 50 years, and the Soviets, who always said we're a reliable supplier, that's over. He has now opened a second front in the war. There's a battlefield in Ukraine. There's also the energy battlefield in Europe.
And do you think he has a big enough lever, if you like, in Russian energy to be able to affect those sort of changes, geopolitical changes in Europe?
I think we saw that the National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, more than increased its representation in the recent election in France, more than tenfold. That's his strategy, bring pro-Russian populists to power. I think this is a very rough game that the outcome is not clear. It's really a race to the winter. Can Europe have enough gas in storage to get through the winter? The situation in world energy is going to get worse, and it's going to, obviously, a lot of the focus will be on Europe, but this is hitting developing countries very hard right now as well, and it's hitting Asia hard.
Couldn't Russia simply turn to China and India and just sell them more?
Well, I think that's true. I think there are limits on it. India's imports of Russian oil have increased, when I last looked, 30-fold. India has now become a very big market for Russian oil. Before this, its main sources of oil were the Middle East, and actually was buying a fair amount of oil and natural gas from the United States, interestingly. But for India, which has had a historic relationship with Russia and one with the Soviet Union, and it's also getting a deal. It's buying Russian oil at a discount, and India imports 85% of its oil. So its balance of payments, its economy is very vulnerable. So India is going down its own course. China, that's a different thing. India is trying to sort of balance between the two sides. It's pretty clear which side China's on, although it's being cautious about avoiding getting caught up in sanctions. But China has certainly stepped up its purchases. And Putin's been saying this for years, and he's now going to try and do it, reorient towards Asia. But it won't take all of his energy. China will not be able to replace Europe. He wants to build a new pipeline. It'll take 4 or 5 years to do that. But one consequence of this is that Russia, instead of being integrated in the global economy, which Putin had been presiding over for 22 years, Russia is going to end up more as an economic dependency of China.
And can Europe turn its back on Russian energy?
Well, I think there's been a very decisive turn, and it's led by the Germans, which have just said, we've made a historic mistake being so dependent on Russian energy. I think many Germans now think it was also a historic mistake to shut down their nuclear power, which made them more dependent on gas imported from Russia. Not all their gas comes from Russia, but over 50% does. But I think Europe is very determined.
More for Poland and other countries.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Poland had very presciently built an LNG receiving plant, liquefied natural gas, so that they could diversify. And in the new map I talk about, I think it's Lithuania that named its LNG receiving terminal Freedom, because they saw that as a way, you know, they did not want to be held hostage by Russia. And I, one of the stories in the new map is how once the Lithuanians were in a position to start importing LNG, miraculously the price that Russia's Gazprom was charging them went down. Isn't that interesting what competition will do? But, and Germany has said that they're going to try in double time or triple time, build at least 4 receiving terminals for LNG, liquefied natural gas. And the Europeans are looking to the United States now for energy security. They see U.S. LNG as essential to their energy security. And that was not the case on February 23rd.
But there are problems, immediate problems with the winter approaching, both of storage capacity and also terminals to process this gas in Europe, aren't there?
You're absolutely right. It's a deadly game that's being played. That's why I say it's a race to the winter. The Europeans want to fill that storage. Putin is trying to prevent them from filling that storage in order to basically create economic chaos and pain in Europe. And so the Europeans, I mean, I've seen them come to the United States, delegations trying to buy more LNG. They're going to Africa. So there's a, in addition to the fragmentation of the global market, there is a reshaping of global energy markets.
And we're also rediscovering new supplies to a certain extent, aren't we, from Israeli and Egyptian and Cypriot fields. Also, even talk here in the UK of renewing energy exploration in the North Sea and also possibly even trying fracking again.
Yes, the British government, which had turned down one license last autumn for natural gas development in the North Sea, has now turned around and has approved a license for development in the North Sea. North Sea has a lot of resources left. And if companies can have some confidence of predictability in government policies and the opportunity, they will invest. And basically, Europe and Britain, I guess we have to distinguish between the two now, see that they do need to develop basically domestic resources as part of their energy security package.
And what about the United States in all this? Is it basically, other than its ability to supply, not affected by what's going on in Ukraine in terms of energy resources?
No, it is affected. It is interesting. I decided to start the new map by just going back and looking at the shale revolution, which was not imagined 15 years ago, and how transformative it has been. It has taken the United States from importing 60% of its oil to being the world's largest producer of oil and gas. And we now see, going back to what we were talking about before, the foreign policy implications of that, how significant it is for Europe to know that there is this resource. The U.S. is affected. Its gas market is not as connected to the world. So it's not seeing the kind of prices that Europe is seeing, or that, you know, Bangladesh is seeing, or other importing countries. But the prices are up. But it does see it in terms of oil, because basically gasoline prices are way up. So this is a major political issue that preoccupies the Biden administration as we head into what are called our midterm congressional elections. And gasoline prices will be a very important factor. And then it all ties together, of course, in the scourge of inflation, which has gripped the world, which central banks have suddenly, you know, pivoted from COVID to inflation, with the specter that recession is seen as more and more likely. That will have some effect on energy prices. But those high gasoline prices, high petrol prices in the United States are very, how should I put it, inflammable political issue.
And what is the capacity and indeed the will of the United States to fill the energy gap in Europe left by cutting off Russia?
In terms of natural gas, it's very strong. Last year, most of the U.S. LNG exports, and the U.S. was on track until there was an accident at one plant, to be the world's largest exporter of LNG. Most of U.S. LNG was going to the Asian markets, to Japan, Korea, and China, which is the biggest buyer of LNG now. The U.S. is supplying significant gas to Europe. In the new map, I describe I call it a discussion I had with Vladimir Putin about shale. I'm being ironic here. This is at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, and he was up there with Chancellor Merkel, and you could see how much they disliked each other just by their body language. And I was told, okay, you can ask the first question. So I asked, what are you going to do to reduce your overdependence on oil and gas? But by accident, I mentioned the word shale, and Putin started shouting at me how environmental disaster, how barbaric it is. And it was very unpleasant to be shouted at by Putin in front of 3,000 people. Believe me, did not make my day. But as I reflected on it, it was two reasons. One, he saw shale was changing and enhancing the position of the United States in the world vis-a-vis Russia. And two, he saw the day coming when U.S. natural gas, LNG, was going to compete with his Russian gas in Europe. And that is exactly what's happening today.
Yet prior to the conflict in Ukraine, the U.S. was actually importing energy from Russia. Why was it doing that?
Yeah, well, as I said before, it was one market. So the market worked on basically economic efficiency. So the U.S. was exporting product to Latin America and importing product from Europe because a lot of the refineries on the East Coast had been shut down for one reason or another. So it's importing a lot of the gasoline that, you know, goes to New York or Boston actually comes from Europe. In addition, the U.S. was importing about 500,000 barrels a day, which is a significant amount of Russian, what's called intermediate product that made refineries that still are on the East Coast run more efficiently and produce more gasoline. And that was banned. So it sometimes sounds a little complicated. You say, well, wait, you're importing and you're exporting. What's going on here? But the key number before this all happened was what are called net imports and exports. After you figure out the exports and you figure out the imports, you say, well, how does it all add up? It all added up to a number where the U.S. was energy independent, which eight presidents had promised since the 1970s.
I mean, one of the things that you've said repeatedly is the world is clearly not running out of oil. And I think that would probably apply to gas as well. So
Can I just jump in? There's the resource, but then one of the things that has happened, and, you know, I noted that we were in a global energy crisis well before the war started. There has been underinvestment in energy resources for the last several years. So we have, going into the war, we had very tight markets. There's very little production, that capacity that can be called into operation. And I think we're paying the price for that right now.
But do you think the war's also reversed that trend now? I mean, we talked about the North Sea.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think partly it has woken up governments to realize that they really need to worry about energy security, which means energy prices and keeping the lights on and keeping their populations mobile and so forth. But energy investment is not a light switch. I mean, you invest now for what you'll have in 3 or 4 years. So it's going to take a little time to reverse this. But it's interesting, you know, European banks would not lend money to African countries for energy development. Well, at the last G7 meeting, they said, well, maybe we should kind of relax that restriction. And that's a change, which, as you say, how the war has changed things. I think that's an example.
The perception would be that for people most concerned about the environment and the pursuit of net zero, things are now moving backwards. Do you think that's right?
I don't think you have energy transition without energy security, and you don't have energy security without energy diversity. So you have to look at this in a more holistic way. One of the things I talk about, which people are only starting to pay attention to, but one of the things I focus on in the new map is, well, what's going to be required for energy transition from a mineral point of view? And the way I put it is we're going to move over time from a world of big oil to a world of big shovels, because you're going to have an enormous need for mining. We've just done a new study on copper, which is the metal of energy transition. It's the metal of electrification. And quantifying how much copper you need to meet the net zero by 2050 goals, and then looking and say, oh, by the way, how much copper is there in the world? Where are these mines? By the way, it takes 16 years to open a new mine. 38% of copper come from two countries, Chile and Peru. China has a big footprint or significant dominance in all of these metals that are required for energy transition. And meanwhile, you see the rift between the U.S. and China, and to some degree Europe and China, only growing deeper, this great power competition. And so you sort of see that the objectives and implementation of energy transition is going to clash with this great power competition between the U.S. and China. And, you know, we're familiar with the traditional geopolitics of oil, but we're going to have a new geopolitics around the supply and what's required for net zero emissions.
That was Dr. Daniel Yergin. Earlier, we heard from Professor Helen Thompson and from Tim Marshall. This episode of Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas was funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer is Murray Jessel, the assistant producer Eve Webster, and the sound engineer Gareth Jones. Worldview will be back soon.
I'm Adam Bolton. Thanks for listening.